from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. U.S. Supreme Court watchers are watching two justices very carefully these days. One is Justice Anthony Kennedy, who just turned 81. He's the longest-serving justice on the court and a crucial swing vote. And there have been rumors Kennedy may be ready to retire, wants to spend more time with his grandkids. Liberals are hoping he will hold out for a few years and outlast a Trump presidency. They're also hoping for and a little worried about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's 84. One reporter for Politico found Justice Ginsburg's personal trainer and tried her workout. After 90 minutes of panting and puffing, he concluded she's in better shape than most of us. It's the first Monday of October, the first day of the Supreme Court's term, so we have with us our two court experts. We're talking about the justices and the cases they'll consider this year. Join us after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The U.S. Supreme Court opens its term today, as it always does, the first Monday in October. The court was down one justice for more than a year after Antonin Scalia died. They were back to full strength in April after Neil Gorsuch was confirmed for the court. And by most accounts, they have a lot on their plate this term. We'll talk about some of those cases, one that could remake the American political landscape, another that could help resolve a conflict between religious freedom and laws banning discrimination. There's another that could set a precedent for just how much privacy we're all entitled to with our cell phones. Last month, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was speaking in Washington. She said, "There's only one prediction that's entirely safe about this upcoming term. It will be momentous." So we're talking about it today with Amy Wildermuth joining us, a professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens. Her work focuses on the Supreme Court and on administrative law. And Professor, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Ronell Anderson-Jones is back with us, also a law professor here at the University of Utah. She clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writes about media and the Supreme Court. And Professor, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Well, before we shift gears, I'm not sure what we can even say. I don't think there's a case on the docket related to guns or gun rights or the Second Amendment, anything like that. Anything you want to say? Obviously, this is on everyone's mind right now after the horrific shooting last night in Las Vegas. Maybe we could start there. Ronell, what are you thinking about right
yeah,
now?
Second Amendment cases have been few and far between at the United States Supreme Court. Indeed, there are only really two to speak of in the modern era that actually set forth constitutional doctrine on this question. And they were a long time in coming, and they were deeply divisive when they happened. So there's a little bit of trickle down that might be happening as a result of those cases that will iron out larger questions about, for example, bans on particular kinds of weapons, certain
That's going to come up.
That for sure, although yep. probably not this term.
No.
And so part of what's happening is that these big watershed cases were quite recent, at least in Supreme Court timelines. And so it takes some time for the nuances of those cases to trickle down into the circuits and get decisions that make their way back to the court to think about some of the specifics. I doubt that we'll see any this term, but these kinds of incidents make their way into the conversation and spur litigation in ways that might not otherwise happen. So I think part of what we need to be watching for is lower court cases that might be animated by the kinds of disasters that we've been seeing.
It's always that lagging effect, right?
Yeah.
The public gets into the public discourse and into the sort of American bloodstream, and then a year, maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, we see justices working some of those questions out.
Well, and the typical setup for something like this is that you have to have some kind of legislation that's being challenged or some legislation at the heart of it so that we actually have a case or controversy so that there's something for the courts to weigh in on. So right now, there isn't anything out there, but maybe in the wake of this, we would see something like that come along.
I guess the question, and this sort of relates to one of the cases we'll talk about, and that's the gerrymandering case, and that is the disposition of the court right now, the Roberts Court, as it relates to letting issues play out in the political landscape or whether justices should take some sort of lead in, you know, pushing these issues forward. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a constant theme at the U.S. Supreme Court. The court is intensely aware of its own sort of precarious position housed in between these two elected branches, right? Yeah. It is democratically unaccountable. They serve for life. They have nothing but their own integrity and goodwill of the American people to keep people obeying the decisions that they hand down. And so there is this dynamic, this sensitivity to those branches, right? An obligation to uphold the Constitution, to step in and say, to act as a watchdog on the other two branches and to say, you have crossed the boundaries that the Constitution sets forth for you, and therefore we declare your acts unconstitutional. Yeah. But an incredible hesitance to step in when it doesn't need to do so because of this delicate balance that it's trying to walk.
Well, and in fact, what the Supreme Court usually does is they wait until we have a pretty mature, what we call a conflict or split among the courts. And if anything, the Supreme Court keeps moving towards deeper and deeper conflicts rather than grabbing a case early.
Yeah. So
I think what we would see is, you know, a true hesitancy to sort of move too quickly. And if you watch the gay marriage progression, right, it is a much slower progression than perhaps other folks would have predicted. But I think that was a conscious decision by the court.
Okay, so what happens today? If you're there at the high court, it's the first Monday. What is the? Is there some kind of ceremony? What is it like?
Not any more ceremony than there is on any other day of oral argument. That is, there's a sitting each month during from October to April, with a recess in February, and the justices come into the room and they begin and announce the docket. There's a buzz in the room on first Monday that doesn't exist in these other days of oral argument because the justices are sort of just getting it's a little like, you know, coming back to school from summer vacation,
right.
And they're connecting with their law clerks, who is a new bunch that have been working for them over the summer, but with whom they haven't had really close connections because the justices are often away.
Yeah.
And so there is this newness of spirit, right? And people are sort of putting their finger on the pulse of the term, looking ahead to the term the way that you would look ahead to a school year. But in terms of pomp and circumstance, the court isn't really into that.
Yeah.
So the gavel will bang and they will begin and oral argument will happen much like it does other times.
Gorsuch getting everyone coffee, or what's the, I know it's such a weird.
He does have to do that. It's true. Yeah. The junior most justice has a lot of obligations there. It's a place that runs on a lot of tradition, and a lot of traditions there run on seniority. So when you are the junior most, there is this notion that you're the last to speak at the court's conferences. You're the one who gets up and gets the coffee and tea. Because conference, no one else is allowed into conference. Yeah. And so the junior most justice will have to go out and fetch things if snacks are needed. Okay. But but mostly the justices are equal in the sense that they all get a vote and they all are going to be assigned opinions over the course of the term. And Gorsuch has not wilted. He's been a strong voice straight out the gate, and I would expect to see more of the same this term.
And we should make clear, this is not when the court is sitting and hearing arguments. This is when they go back and they meet quietly together. He does these sort of smaller chores. And there is some, you know, lore about this, that justices will pretend to have forgotten their glasses or forgotten something else. So they have to go and answer the door multiple times. But it's not in public. And of course, there's no rules in terms of, you know, the order in which people can speak during an argument.
So what are you sensing about Justice Gorsuch now. We've seen him in action a couple of months before the term ended. And I guess the question that I wondered about was, so you have one conservative filling in for another conservative. So how is the court really all that different? One's a gregarious, intelligent, kind of brilliant person filling in for another one. I mean, what's different, really?
Not that much. I mean, I not that much in terms of, I think, votes and outcome, right?
That should be the same.
The likelihood is great that they will overlap significantly. Gorsuch's small number of opinions in which he participated last term, he aligned with Clarence Thomas, who very often aligned with Justice Scalia. So he's sort of filling in ideologically the same position, and his personality in some respects is parallel. They both write with a little bit of a tartness. They are sharp and quick on their feet. They have similar sort of big personalities in that respect. I mean, the big difference is that you're replacing a very senior conservative justice with a very junior one. And so it was one thing for Justice Scalia to be sort of taking those positions and being a little bit bombastic in oral argument or taking kind of pot shots every once in a while in his dissents at his colleagues. It's another thing for the new guy on the block to be doing so. And so that's generated some conversation. Yeah, he is a little bit. Yeah.
He has certainly made himself heard at oral argument. And so there's lots of reports about this. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that people are surprised because this isn't anything that you wouldn't have seen on the 10th Circuit. I think perhaps what people are surprised by is that when you get to the Supreme Court, you are no longer bound in the same way that you were if you were a Court of Appeals judge. And so I think we're just seeing that from Gorsuch. But I have to say that it is surprising to me that so many people are surprised by the positions he's taking. I think these are the positions most of us anticipated he would take. He has a certain style. He certainly has involved himself in many things outside of the court that have drawn some attention. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's grown up around politicians. And so I think this is something that he has done in the past. Perhaps he did not realize how much attention it would draw now that he's a Supreme Court justice. But that's it seems to me that he's doing many things just as he did when he was on the 10th Circuit.
Well, we should point out, so this was just last Thursday, Justice Gorsuch gave a speech to this conservative group called the Fund for American Studies. Now, justices do this kind of thing all the time.
Yes.
I think what people paid attention to was the fact that he had done it at a Trump hotel. What do you make of that? I mean, people, there's a little bit of pushbacks. I'm trying to figure out why that's such a big deal. I mean, we all know Trump did nominate him, but people are talking about how the optics maybe weren't so good.
Yeah, I think that is just a question of optics, right? He certainly is not anywhere close to the only justice to ride around given speeches. Justices on both the right and the left do so, and they do so often to groups that have an ideological bent to the right or the left. So even that is not rare, right? We see people like Justices Ginsburg and Breyer regularly speaking to the American Constitution Society, which is a sort of progressive legal group, or Justice Scalia regularly spoke to the Federalist Society, which sort of leans to the right. And so those kinds of appearances, I think, happen all the time. I think a part of it is that there's this sort of heightened focus on someone who's new, and a particularly heightened focus on the Trump administration, right? The Trump administration and the sort of propriety of being a Trump, the major Trump nominee that just ends up getting a lot of focus. And the truth is that Gorsuch is the manifestation of the major Trump promise for a lot of like sort of fringe Trump voters, right? There is a very large group of people in this country. The data demonstrates, the polling data makes really clear.
This was driving votes.
A lot of folks who otherwise were not really keen on Donald Trump as a candidate, who held their nose and voted for him in order to bring about Justice Gorsuch and subsequent nominations to the bench. And so I think that's part of why there's this kind of intensity of focus on his behaviors and what he's doing, because it was a campaign issue.
Go ahead.
I have to say, it is interesting that there's not much talk about what he actually said in those appearances. So this really is about the optics, to really think through what does it look like and the kind of attention that you get. And I have no idea if he anticipated he would get that much attention or if this is sort of new and he's trying to figure out if this is the way he's going to proceed through his career on the Supreme Court. Most justices shy away from this kind of publicity. They don't want to be national news. So we'll see as, you know, time goes on, how he will manage this in the future.
I have to say, just as an observer of some of the reluctant justices versus some of the more talkative ones, Breyer is on one end and Justice O'Connor was on the other. I mean, she was – if you've ever heard an interview, it's the most maddening thing in the world. She's the most was the most evasive person to talk to. I can't imagine.
Although we have to say, Breyer just gave an interview where they asked him, "Are you a feminist?" He said, "I don't know what that is." So I think they can all have a few answers that are interesting in this when they are interviewed.
I think it's true that Justice O'Connor had an incredible sensitivity to this sort of thing. So as her law clerk, I had responsibility sometimes for writing drafts of public remarks that she would give.
Really?
And part of what she wanted to do was sort of be this voice of the rule of law, right? An advocate for large scale kind of macro principles in the country, the importance of the role of the judiciary, the importance of the independence of the judiciary. And she didn't want in the sort of zeal of missionarying that cause to undercut that cause, right? The whole point of having an independent judiciary is that you're not out there proclaiming your positions on particular things or even speaking about the courts positions on things. And so she was very, very careful not to tread anywhere close to anything that might ever come before the court so that they could be seen as neutral arbiters of those decisions.
We should probably point out that Justice Gorsuch, I think, Professor, that you were saying, he didn't really say anything terribly controversial. He was talking about civility and the founders. This is how it worked. But as we said, the optics kind of looked a little dicey. Maybe you'll rethink that next time, I guess. You probably learned a lesson.
I mean, that's the question. Yeah. I do think if you were to go back and you watched him on the 10th Circuit and the many times he would give speeches, he was very open to going around the country and talking. And I have to say there's something to be said for the justices going out into the world and not being, you know, sort of hidden away and nobody gets to see them. It's just a really difficult balance.
Yeah.
He's got it down in terms of what he had to say, again, because very few people noted anything controversial about what he said. In fact, no one. It was more where he did it, how he did it, who he was with.
Let's talk about Anthony Kennedy, because, in fact, I want to focus on, just before we head into the cases, the two justices that people are paying attention to a lot right now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, who's 84, and let's talk about Anthony Kennedy, who's 81. And rumors swirling, I think, in the spring about he's not hiring clerks, what's going on? He's talking a lot about his grandkids. And, of course, liberals are freaking out because that could potentially mean another seat open to President Trump to fill. What is your sense of what's going on as you're seeing things now with Kennedy?
It isn't hyperbole to say that this is Anthony Kennedy's court.
Yeah.
The statistics are really overwhelming on this. I mean, I think last term he was in the majority 97% of the time. Mm. So as goes Tony Kennedy, so goes the court. And sometimes these are just majority opinions that garner, you know, loads of votes and maybe 9-0 opinions. But it also means that he's the deciding vote in the 5-4. When it's 5-4, he's the 5.
Yeah.
And it means sometimes he's with a block of justices who are conservative and sometimes he's with a block who are liberal. And he's the swing who is moving both directions. So when you occupy that center space, the attention focuses on you, and rightly so. His vote is he's the person that people are going to be speaking to when they get up and argue the big cases this term. They're all going to be talking to Justice Kennedy. So That means that people really want to know whether he's going to be around, how long he's going to be around. Traditionally, we should say justices, unless there is some massive health issue or family issue, do not announce that they are stepping down during a term. So now that First Monday has happened today,
it's done.
Yeah, yeah. We will hear from him, if at all, right, in June or July, right, when all of the cases from the term have been handed down. But the speculation is about whether we will do that. Yeah. And there is certainly a lot of buzz. A lot of people who watch the court love to read every tea leaf that they can possibly find. So they think about whether clerks are being hired. They think about he had a reunion of former yeah. clerks that was yeah. a little off in its timing, and everyone tried to imbue that with lots of meaning. There was some notion that he wanted to leave because of his age, but didn't want to do so in the first term of the Trump administration because it would sort of be politically, it would look strange politically, and you'd want to sort of ride that out after the Gorsuch hearings.
Gorsuch, though, is that
Gorsuch is his
former clerk.
Yeah.
So it was always all that talk that was one of the reasons the Trump administration selected Gorsuch, because Kennedy would feel good about that pick and feel better about potentially
right.
retiring.
This is, of course, all just chatter.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we just try to find as many things as we can.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just talk. Right. Nobody but Anthony Kennedy and perhaps his right immediate confidants really could say.
I guess I just ask one question. If you were Justice Kennedy, would you step down? You got a lot of power. It yeah. just seems to me that he's never shirked from that role. I think it makes him extraordinarily powerful on the Supreme Court. And one can imagine that would not be a role that you would walk away lightly from. So I don't believe any of
yeah,
it.
Yeah. How do you peg his, for want of a better term, his ideological perspective? I mean, he seems to be kind of all over the map. I mean, the same-sex marriage, he was crucial in that. He reaffirmed the core holding of Roe back in the 90s, Roe versus Wade. But he also wrote the Citizens United opinion. He also sided with Bush in Bush v. Gore. So what do you make of where he tends to be? Like, is there a legal consistency that you see in those decisions?
I think the best that I could do with what he has done over his career is that, obviously, if you were just to line up votes, it's more conservative than you would argue is than liberal, right?
Yeah.
So you could at least do that basic cut. I think he cares very deeply about the perception of the court and the perception of American courts generally. So he is interested in making sure that it doesn't look as if we are an embarrassment of some sort, and that everything is running efficiently, correctly, right? We're making good decisions about how the judicial system works. Beyond that, you know, it can be difficult. He often does not want to say never, right? So he's the, you know, never say never guy. And that actually will come up in the redistricting case. In a prior case that came out of Pennsylvania, he was the one who said in a very split decision, I don't know that this case meets what I think we might have to do in terms of a test. It's very hard to come up with a test, but I'm not going to go with the never say never crowd. I'm not going to go with the never crowd because I'm a never say never guy. So I think it's, you know, his jurisprudence can be tricky. It can be challenging, but I think it's very, you know, it's set in whatever the facts and circumstances are around a particular case. And then he takes that as it is. And then we can go forward, you know, with some basic ideas about how this is a perception of the Supreme Court and the American judicial system.
You've pointed out that a lot of people are scrambling to get cases heard by the court as long as there is a Kennedy. There's some maneuvering going on, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And conversely, might be holding back on litigation strategies until they see what happens. Because, of course, as we discussed earlier, one does not bring a case and then arrive at the Supreme Court the next day.
Right.
It has to get litigated through the lower federal courts or the lower state courts, and then at an appellate level, and then certiorari has to be granted by the court to review it. So a case that was just started now would not make its way to the United States Supreme Court until a subsequent term. And so there's some I hear from advocacy groups some sort of holding back to see how things play out.
Because they won't know until June or July.
That's
maybe,
right.
If they know at all.
That's right.
Okay, so before we head back to a break and to the cases, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I read a great piece in Politico. One of the reporters found her trainer and tried to do her workout routine.
It's the best. It's
and
a really
it
great.
Killed him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and she was this sort of, okay. Mid-30s fit
yeah.
gentleman
yeah.
Who was trying to do the daily workout of an 84-year-old. And his point was, there's a lot of sort of health watch for Justice Ginsburg. Everyone wants to, the woman sneezes and everyone wants right. to sort of hover and talk about whether she's well. And part of this is that she's a cancer survivor and she had a stent in her heart. But she has had some health difficulties and she is getting up there in years. Yeah. But the truth is, by all reports, she's quite strong physically and working very hard to stay so. I mean, that report was sort of – I mean, I read it too and – it's got, she's doing these planks and these chin-ups and
right, 90 minutes or something.
She's doing, cardio. I think she's doing her level best to keep herself in good shape and, not to put too fine a point on it, to keep herself on this court.
And there's no doubt that she's enjoying what she does. She gets out there in the world. We get to hear more of her views of things. She's obviously much more candid in her later years than she has been. And I think it is clear that her sort of interest in the Supreme Court and being a Supreme Court justice has not waned. So there's no way she's going to want to step down. And I don't believe that as long as it's in her power, she will leave the Supreme Court anytime soon.
It's Amy Wildermuth, professor of law at the University of Utah. Ranelle Anderson-Jones, also a professor there. And we are going to get to the cases when we get back from a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It is the first Monday in October, which of course means the U.S. Supreme Court is now back in session, which is giving us a chance to gather our two legal experts and court watchers, Amy Wildermuth and Ranelle Anderson-Jones. We're talking about what to look for and what could happen in this new term. And a lot could happen, turns out. So let's start with gerrymandering. This is a case I've been reading some of the – I don't want to say hyperbole, but because it seems like they're probably right. But one description said this case could transform political maps from City Hall to Congress, potentially for the benefit of Democrats, could remake an American political landscape. Do you think that's about right in terms of the importance of this case?
I think it's absolutely right. And if you think about where we are with political gerrymandering today, and many of the amicus briefs talk about this particular topic, it's a very technical exercise in terms of big data and the ability of computer models to really secure a district for a particular party. And we've gotten better and better and better at this to the point where we are slicing and dicing states into pretty set districts so that they really not only are uncontested, for a few years, we're talking many, many years. They are entrenched for a particular political party. Political science folks have been saying, hey, this is a problem for some time.
Yeah.
And the question has always been, will the court be able to find the hook, that is, find a workable rule so that they can do something on political gerrymandering? Or as I suggested before in the prior Pennsylvania case, when they, we had four justices say, this is just way too messy. We can't come up with a workable rule. We're just going to stay out of it. It looks like we have five justices that are very interested in doing something. Mm-hmm. And this case out of Wisconsin presents a pretty striking situation. We have very secure seats for the Republican Party, which drew the lines. And in a state like Wisconsin, which is fairly evenly divided, meaning it goes back and forth between, the sort of popular votes for Republicans versus Democrats. It's almost 50% for each side. And yet the Republicans have an overwhelming majority in the state assembly, to the tune in 2012 of 60 seats out of 99. And in 2014, 63 seats out of those 99, which doesn't match up with the percentage, again, of sort of the number of people who voted Republican or Democrat.
Yeah. Democrats won the popular vote.
They won it, yes, in 2012. They did not in 2014.
Right.
And the difference for the Democrats, they were 51.4% in 2012, and they got 39 seats. So remember, Republicans got 60, they got 39. And then Democrats went down to 48%, and they got 36 seats, and the Republicans got 63 seats in 2014. That's a pretty striking and remarkable difference in sort of the, you know, popular vote versus how many seats that would yield you.
Let me just zoom out a little bit, because if you look at the national sort of spin on this question, Democrats' share of state legislative seats, you know, across the board in this country has shrunk to a level not seen since the 1920s. And some think this is one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some decent chance that that's exactly what's happening. And the retrenching is one of the reasons why it's so concerning, is that, of course, the result of you getting 60% of your state legislature is that you, the next time around, get to redraw the districts.
Yeah.
So this is a self-fulfilling prophecy that happens over and over again. And some of the statistical models that the political scientists are putting forward are suggesting that, right, this gap of time, the 10-year census gap that happens in most states where that's when we sort of redraw to account for population growth, they have now come up with mechanisms for entrenching so deeply that they hold on to that power for those 10 years, whereupon they regain that power again or dig in deeper to get it. It isn't exclusively a Republican problem.
No.
And a lot of what's been happening in the briefing is sort of, I think this is to Justice Kennedy, right, is briefing that says right now the predominant challenges are to Republican redistricting plans. The one that's here in Wisconsin is a Republican plan, and the North Carolina one that's getting a lot of attention is. But there's a Maryland situation going on that's the exact opposite, where the Democrats are doing the same thing. And there are, in fact, there's an amicus brief before the court in this case from a team of really top-level prominent Republican politicians. John McCain and Kasich and Arnold Schwarzenegger, people who have themselves participated in this behavior, who are saying something's wrong with our democracy, right? This is a threat to each person having a represented vote and being able to have their voice heard. We have actually for decades had a clear constitutional doctrine on these gerrymanderings when they're done for racial purposes.
Yeah.
So it's very clear. We have a very clear doctrine that says if you redraw these to try to clump together people in minority groups or clump together white voters, it is a constitutional violation, right? That affects one's capacity to have their fundamental right to vote. And so the question here is whether this sort of extreme partisan motivation rises to that same level. And we have some sort of inkling from at least some of the justices that it does. And the question is whether there's a fifth vote there to say this first is the kind of question that we, the court, think we can come up with the tools to handle. We can give an answer. It's manageable by us. And if so, what is that sort of workable standard that helps us to know when they've crossed the line between doing the sort of thing that sort of the victor gets the spoils and crossing that boundary to a place where the victor is not just getting the spoils, but rather is ensuring victory in the future over the desires of the voters in the state.
Do you have so this Wisconsin case offers that kind of clarity, may give them the traction to be able to?
There's some suggestion that for the first time we have a formula. There is. There is a really good social science data that has come up to sort of thinking about what they're calling the efficiency gap, thinking about what are sometimes labeled wasted votes, right? If you're the 48% Democrats in a district that has been drawn to be perpetually 51% Republicans, then you are never, never, never having your voice heard. And there's this calculation, a fairly complicated mathematical calculation that has been sort of emerged over the years that has gained some traction in the lower courts. And it, coupled with sort of evidence of partisan motivation, right? There's some lower court – the lower court in this Wisconsin case said, we can't actually come up with any explanation for the shape of these districts, which sort of have tentacles and arms and, right, they're not square or rectangle. They're octopus, right? And we can't come up with any explanation for this save for your desire to make this a very Republican district and to squelch the Democratic vote. There is some packaging of that formula that suggests to court watchers that we may be at a place where the gerrymandering, the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering, may be a decidable issue for the court.
And what Ronell just described, people call cracking. This is the term that you hear when people start talking about gerrymandering. They also talk about packing. So the other thing that can happen is that you pack all of the Democrats into a certain district, right? And you then have a somebody winning by 72-73%, right?
But only that district.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so you have these overwhelming majorities in some districts, or you have this, you know, very, very slight majority for the Republicans in this instance in Wisconsin. And those are the two things that really people start to talk about, those wasted votes. And this, it gets to the principle, if we want to hook it to a constitutional principle here, it really is about one person, one vote. That's how most folks are thinking about this. And whether we can back a test out of that so that we can really come up with a functional way to analyze these cases, that's the challenge for the justices.
Somebody said that the current situation is like the German Autobahn. You can, right now, you can go as fast as you want. You can draw the boundaries however you want. And the question is whether the high court is going to try and put on the brakes. Would you say you think it will?
Oh, it's all up to Justice Kennedy.
So that, he's the fifth one on this one.
Without question, he is the fifth one on this. The four conservative justices have, in all likelihood,
we'll say let the political process
we'll say this
play
belongs
on
to and, the political process. Yeah. There is not an appropriate role for the court here, and the four liberal justices are likely to find this to be akin to the other gerrymandering issues that they've talked about in the past.
I don't think they take it unless they thought there was something that could be done. Yeah. I mean, they could just deny it. There's many of these cases that are percolating up. And we just have to remember that the state of the technology now, and that, again, has been documented over and over again, is that you can really build very, very interesting districts, again, that can retrench. And it's also an interesting question for us to ask if that is the reason that we have such divided partisan, you know, we're at this very, very divided partisan moment. Is that because we've created all these districts that are safe, if you will, they're supposed to be set for certain folks, and then people go to the extremes of those parties to ensure that they get elected in those in those districts? I mean, it's a fascinating question. And again, some of these amicus briefs actually go into that concern and what it may be doing to our democracy.
Something like 54 amicus briefs. Is that unusual?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I saw cases with that many the term that I was there, but they were the blockbuster cases, which is what this is.
It's a big one.
All right, here's what seems like a blockbuster case. I'm not sure if you see it that way. That's a case that originated in Lakewood, Colorado. A baker named Jack Phillips refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple, Charlie Craig and David Mullins. It takes four votes to add a case to the docket. They did. How are you seeing the significance of this particular case? And because I want to get to the questions that are really at stake. It seems like there's a big conflict here.
Yeah, there's a huge conflict here. The title of the case actually often doesn't matter to us, but this case is titled Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And there's a reason that this guy calls his cake shop the masterpiece. I mean,
he fancies himself an artist.
He does, right? And this is sort of this is a case of really perfect facts. If you wanted to test this tension, and the tension, to be clear, is a tension between public accommodation laws that say in all 50 states, if you're going to open a business that is open to the public, you may not discriminate against the customers who come in on the basis of a wide variety variety of bases, race and gender and here sexual orientation. And so these customers said, you can't say that you won't make a wedding cake for us when you would make a wedding cake for anybody else who comes in the door. That violates this public accommodations law. So that's the sort of pressure on the one side. On the other side is this man's First Amendment rights. And he says, I am not just a person who is selling, you know, widgets here. I'm not Home Depot. I am Masterpiece Cake Shop, where I am creating works of art, and you are asking me to write words on a cake, right? Congratulations, Charlie and his husband, that I don't believe in. And so there's an undercurrent here, two First Amendment undercurrents.
One, so you're saying his cake baking is a form of speech.
That's right. It's compelled speech. And we have a long set of doctrine from the Supreme Court that already says that the government may not, in its laws, compel you to speak. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about this case as the sort of next step in this really central culture war is that Justice Kennedy at the center of it has been the most adamant voice for both of those principles.
Yeah.
So he is the author
of— He's all for
of,
free speech and he's all for defending the rights
every of— major LGBTQ case that has come down from the Supreme Court in the last generation has been authored by Anthony Kennedy.
Wow.
He was the author of the gay marriage case. He was the author of Lawrence versus Texas, which sort of kickstarted this movement. And he's passionate in these opinions about the importance of protecting the liberty of these folks. But conversely, he is also— – there is no more passionate writer on the court today on First Amendment issues,
wow,
on one's capacity to be able to think and express oneself. And so which of those buttons is going to get pushed here I think is going to be a really interesting question.
What do you think?
So I think that Kennedy will be writing. We've already established that. And how it comes out, we will not know until June. But I do think when I went through the amicus briefs, and there's already 50 and they're not all in, there's an interesting one that comes from other cake artists. And it's not in support of either side, but it says we are in fact artists. And the really remarkable thing about this case is that the folks who have brought it have really shaped it as a First Amendment case. This is about expression, right? This is about speech, and it puts it in a very different bucket. You'll remember there was a New Mexico case that involved a photographer, and it was the same sort of thing. Are these folks artists that have these First Amendment protections, and therefore they can sort of remove themselves as artists? Now, we have to say there's also a really interesting fact in this case. Jack Phillips offered to sell other cakes,
yep,
to this couple.
Right.
He just said, I won't make you one.
Right.
So
this is
ordinary,
not him saying, I will not serve you.
I won't make you a custom wedding. He said, and he can't do— he's no longer allowed to make custom wedding cakes for anyone now, right? I mean, he said, that's a significant part of my business, but I'm going to forego that to stay within this realm of—
So if we go back to Ronell's widget, right, he says, I was willing to sell you the widget, the sort of basic cake.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to do my artistry, right? I wasn't going to use my artistry to create a cake for you.
But how far does that go? Can a florist say, I'm an artist? Can a photographer say, I'm an artist?
It turns out that everybody who works for a wedding has some sort of argument.
Like a caterer can say, look, these canapés are so beautifully presented.
Right.
I'm an artist.
And the wedding coordinator. I mean, I make the whole scene, right? I mean, the art, all of it arguably could become under this protection. That's why it's going to be a very interesting opinion.
And in many respects, it's a very clever litigation strategy, right?
Absolutely.
Because
on the
on the part of Masterpiece, right? And folks who are
clever,
finding because the instinct post Obergefell and the language from Obergefell is the gay marriage opinion that Justice Kennedy himself authored, saying, right, you have a constitutional right to do this. There's language in this opinion from Justice Kennedy himself saying people, of course, will still have the right to object on religious grounds to these marriages. People can still have fervently held views that gay marriage is conflicts with their own religious principles. And he went out of his way to say so. And so this triggered in some people's minds, oh, well, the next round is going to be people pushing back and saying, I should have a religious objection and I should be able to be accommodated as a religious matter not to serve. But what they've done is not made this a First Amendment freedom of religion case, but rather a First Amendment
freedom of speech.
This is an expressive freedom. It's all tinged with this really. I mean, the masterpiece title is actually not just because he thinks of himself as an artist, but it's a Christian reference.
It's Jesus.
It's a Christian reference.
And he's closed on Sundays.
Yes. Yeah. So, but the mode of getting to the justices, the mode of arguing to Justice Kennedy, is that this is compelled speech. Which I think is going to be a really, really tough tension to work out.
What is he going to do? It's a ridiculous question, but what do you sense that where he may come down?
This is going to be a very tricky one. This is one where we really need to see the argument, and you really have to figure out exactly, you know, what Kennedy gives away in that argument. My sense is that he is going to be really. It is going to be tough because he's going to be really stuck between those two principles, right? Free expression and sort of his personal investment in LGBTQ sorts of cases so far. So I think it is a very, very difficult spot for him to be in.
It's almost as if the other justices don't exist, right? Everyone's just going to be paying attention to him, right? I mean,
the New York Times and Washington Post story the day after this is argued, the day after oral argument, will have. Will quote every word that drips from Anthony Kennedy's lips. And people will try to sort of parse through what sort of signals he's sending and what sorts of concerns he has. That's what's going to be the focus.
And watch, he'll say not a thing.
Mess with us. Yeah.
Rennell Anderson-Jones is with us, teaches law at the University of Utah. Amy Wildermuth also teaches law here at the University of Utah. A few more cases to get to when we get back from a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about we didn't get to as many cases as I thought we would. We've got a few minutes left, but we're talking about some of the arguments are going to be made in some of these high-profile cases with Rennell Anderson-Jones, teaches law at the University of Utah Law School, and Amy Wildermuth also teaches law there. Okay, so let's talk about this. Carpenter, what is it? Carpenter versus
United States.
United States. Now, this is how big is this? I mean, this is about privacy in the digital age, in the ages of technology. Lay this case out for us and talk about what's crucial here.
The case involves this guy Carpenter, who quite ironically was charged with robberies of cell phone stores. So it's the cell phone case in a couple of ways. Part of the case that the government made against him involved tracking his movements with his own cell phone from geographic data that is gathered by cell phone towers from his cell phone provider. And so for 120 plus days, they gathered this data of everywhere he was. And it turned out, lo and behold, he was all the places where the robberies were happening. And so it was a pretty crucial piece of evidence. He challenged this and said, that's not the sort of thing that you can just go and get on this low standard of an ask under the Stored Communications Act.
Because there was no warrant.
There was no warrant. Yeah. He said, this is a Fourth Amendment issue. This was a search and seizure. And I had a reasonable expectation of privacy in those movements. And so you, the government, have to get a warrant in order to get it. And this question is huge because our question, the sort of development of the Fourth Amendment in a modern technological age is a real conundrum, a real question about what sorts of things count as people searching us and seizing us, and what sorts of things count as a reasonable expectation of privacy, which is the standard that the court has used to tell us when we do or do not need to have these warrants. And I think this is going to be a really big blockbuster case. One piece that's at issue here is there's an old doctrine that is referred to as the third party doctrine. It's the idea that you can't possibly have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something that you've already voluntarily provided to some third party. And here he signed, like we all do, a contract with the cell phone company that said,
even though
sure,
you have no idea what it
says.
None
of us read it.
We all signed them.
We all read it.
Even the lawyers are admitting that we did.
Exactly.
That's But we've all agreed in principle to the fact that the cell phone company can have these towers and can track this data on us and can collect it. They can possess it. And so having given that to the cell phone company, ostensibly the argument is he has given up his there's no reasonable expectation that it was private, and therefore the government doesn't need the warrant. The pushback is, of course, that this is a pretty private thing, that where I'm going all the time and where I will be and where I have been is a pretty intimate sort of big brothery feel to it. And the Fourth Amendment folks are on fire about this case.
Yeah, and if I could just add to this, it's very interesting because the cell phone records here are not about the numbers he called. We have to understand that. It's really about the location data, which is a whole new technological innovation. And as Ronell suggested, this does really start to make people think long and hard about what it is that they're giving to the cell phone company. I mean, you can imagine the other things that go along with your cell phone at this point. And it does signal that we probably are in store for a rethinking of this third party doctrine, meaning the things that you are handing over to the cell phone company. Do we really believe that you are voluntarily giving that information to the cell phone company, or should you have an expectation of privacy in it?
So where are the justices settling in?
We have a couple of recent cases that already sort of suggest some movement in this direction on technology and privacy. There's a case a couple of years ago where the government didn't get it from a cell phone company, but instead just stuck a GPS tracker on a car. And doing that without a warrant was struck as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. There was also a case
overwhelmingly
a strong majority of the court. There's some sense that they feel that privacy is implicated by these sorts of movements. There's also a really recent case involving taking your cell phone, the data off of your cell phone, the information off of your cell phone when you're arrested and sort of looking through your cell phone at that point. And likewise, that came out in favor of the criminal defendant. So we have some markers along the way that suggest that there's an arc here, and it may be that this third party doctrine is the next thing to go.
And we should say that the Fourth Amendment cases don't typically break down in the 5-4 split. I mean, even for a blockbuster case, when you have a Fourth Amendment case, back when we were at the court, this would have been one where you could see Stevens and Scalia going together. So the usual lines that people think about at the Supreme Court don't necessarily apply in the context of this particular case. And it is clear that many justices are uncomfortable with where the third party doctrine leaves us in terms of where, you know, modern society is today.
We're essentially out of time. Help me wrap up really quickly. When you rate this upcoming term to others, is this a big deal?
It's big. I mean, we just talked about a number of cases that would have been a blockbuster in any term, and they're all happening in a single term. And the court will continue to grant cert, that is, agree to hear appeals, all the way through January.
So we may yet see more.
I think it's going to be a very big term, very important.
I would add to that that actually they've been quite slow granting certs. So we could see a lot of cases that are even more interesting than this. I was there in 2002 when Lawrence was decided, the University of Michigan affirmative action cases. That was a true blockbuster year. We might get topped this year.
Well, we know Ginsburg has the energy.
That's right.
Amy Wildermuth teaches law at the University of Utah. Ronell Anderson-Joan also teaches law there. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Very much.
We'll
have you back
here.
There's a lot to talk about.
Thank you
very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Thanks to our intern, Anthony Scoma. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.